Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome everyone. If you're one of the millions of Americans who does not get enough sleep, we have some proven rest strategies for coming up, getting yourself well rested and revved up coming up later on today. I'll also talk with DT Max about his National Geographic special, The Secrets of Sleep. Coming up around 12:25, I'll be talking with award-winning science and medical writer Marin McKenna about what's been termed in the medical world as a fatal menace and the most frightening epidemic since AIDS. It's been around for 40 years or more, but medicine disregarded it and antibiotics can't control it. Once prevalent only in hospitals, it's now reached gymnasiums, it's reached schools. It's been detected in our food chain from cows to chickens and pigs. And today we're going to look at how that affects us. We're going to take some empowering looks at what we need to know about this drug-resistant staph so that we can protect our families and, in particular, what we should know if a loved one is about to head into hospital. I actually had a brother-in-law in hospital last week who was booted out of hospital one day after having a kidney removed because of this infection, because of this bug. So certainly I want to learn more about it. And I think based on evidence, the fact that it's growing, we need to be well-armed. So coming up first, we're going to look at a very common problem, a lot less harmful for most people. If you're one of the many Americans who doesn't get enough sleep, you might be interested to know that there are as many as 90 known sleep disorders. And I say 90 known disorders because the fact is we can put men on the bottom of our oceans. We can Google Earth and see our relative's house, you know, the other side of the world. And yet we really know very little about sleep. We don't even know why we need to sleep. So I sat down with DT Max. He's a journalist. He's written a book called The Family That Couldn't Sleep, A Medical Mystery. It was named one of the five best nonfiction books of the year by Salon.com. But he's also done a special with National Geographic. It's called The Secrets of Sleep. It appears in the May 2010 issue of National Geographic magazine. And it's also on National Geographic channel as an explorer program called Fatal Familial Insomnia. So we're going to learn more about that. I recorded this interview last week because of scheduling problems, and we're going to bring it to you right now. The journalist is DT Max. So DT, I wanted to, first of all, thank you for being with us today. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how you got this particular assignment on insomnia, and we're going to go much more into details in a moment. But how did this interest come about? How did you get this assignment?
Well, you know, I've been interested in sleep for a long time. Sleep is one of the great mysteries of our lives, why we spend 8 hours a day, you know, inert. What is it that this does for us? I've always been curious about sleep. I think it's one of the least understood of human behaviors. More directly, I was looking for you know, medical stories that would cross international borders for a magazine assignment I had, and I was on the phone with a neurologist in Chicago, and I sort of said to him, you know, well, you know, what do you have? And he said to me that he had just had a patient who had died of insomnia. And I said to him, you know, that's impossible. Everybody knows that nobody ever died from lack of sleep.
Right.
And he said, that's what you think. So I said, you got to come and see you. This is really, you know, this is what I do. I'm a journalist who writes often about medical subjects. I really want to come and talk to you. And he said, wait. He said, I've got a family. I know of a family in Italy who had an inherited form of this condition for 200 years. And I said, where in Italy? And he said, you know, near Venice. And I thought to myself, well, would I rather go to Chicago or to Venice? And so I got my passport.
No contest there. And this particular insomnia that you focused on for your book and for the National Geographic Explorer show is called Fatal Familial Insomnia, FFI, something I'd never heard of. I'm suspecting many people had not. But it doesn't affect too many families in the world, but it really is fatal, as it suggests, isn't it?
Yes, you know, it's an extremely rare inherited condition. About 50 to 70 families in the world have it or have been diagnosed with it. There are probably a few more, you know, not in contact with the kind of medicine that gets you such an unusual diagnosis. But the disease has proven to be a real treasure trove for researchers. It shed light on a lot of more common diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, and then also, of course, it shed a lot of light on the great and enduring mystery of whether we need sleep or why we need sleep.
Mm. So let's talk a little bit about one of the case studies that was discussed. Silvano is the one I'm thinking of. He was age 53 when he was diagnosed. I wonder if you'd just take us a little bit through his journey.
Yeah, sure. Now, so Silvano is a member of a family that for a long time has known that they, you know, have some sort of terrible medical condition, some sort of dementia that strikes in late middle age. And Silvano is begins to have the typical symptoms of the disease, which actually the disease doesn't begin with insomnia. Fatal and familial insomnia, as you will see and hear in the National Geographic article and documentary, begins with your pupils contracting to tiny pinpricks. That's the first sign of the disease. And then you begin to sweat uncontrollably. After that, you begin to have trouble napping. And then as the disease progresses, you can no longer sleep properly through the night. And then after about 3 or 4 months, you can't sleep at all. And you enter this kind of twilight. Well, Silvano knew what was going on. And he was determined to, you know, face this disease in a way that his family had never been able to. So he went to a sleep clinic in Bologna, and he went in, and the neurologist there was telling him, you know, it's not so bad, and, you know, we'll find ways to help you, and, you know, we can't cure you, we'll at least, you know, make your life more comfortable. And he basically, he turned to them, he was a very powerful, competent man, and he just said, forget all this nonsense, he said, I assume when I'm dead you'll want my brain. That was Silvano. Silvano was a courageous man.
Yeah, yeah.
And a man who was really the first to say, you know, we have to begin to peel away some of the layers of the mystery of our family disease.
And normally, I read in the article that people normally die within 15 months of the first symptoms of this disease. Is that fairly typical?
That's right. It's a disease. Fatal familial insomnia is a disease that typically, you know, lasts about 15 months. There are actually two forms of it, but in the more potent and more common form. And it's really a very, you know, from a genetic point of view, it's a very simple situation where you make an improper copy of a gene that creates a protein, and this protein, when it's misformed, begins to do some very devious things in your brain. But it takes about 15 to 19 months typically.
You know what surprised me the most, DT, was how little we know about sleep. We can put men on the moon, and yet we don't even know why we need to sleep or how we fall asleep even. That, I thought that was really surprising. Did it surprise you?
It continues to surprise me and to fascinate me. Sleep is optimally something we spend a third of our lives doing, and we know less about it, I think, than things that, you know, I mean, than behavior which, well, one can't even imagine a behavior about which we, I mean, if we knew as little about sleep as we did about eating, we would have no nutritional recommendations. Sleep is a process we know we need. And anyone can tell you on a common sense level that if you don't get enough sleep, you know, you're muddle-headed, you're uncomfortable, you can't make good decisions, you shouldn't operate heavy machinery, as they say, on the side of, you know, pill containers. But on a physiological level, we really don't understand what sleep does. There was a famous researcher named Alan Rechtschaffen, famous sleep researcher, and Rechtschaffen once said that if sleep doesn't serve some absolutely vital purpose, it's the greatest mistake that nature ever made. What he meant by that is, you know, you're making great efforts to sleep. You're especially, you know, if you can imagine humans not in our era of cars and houses, but when we were, you know, competing with other animals on the plains of Africa, the decision that for 8 hours you're going to lie immobile and unprotected would seem to be a catastrophic evolutionary decision. And yet, you know, we know that all animals sleep. So from the fact that all animals sleep, you can deduce that all animals need to sleep, but we still don't really know why.
Yeah, it was interesting in the National Geographic article and the program, the preview I saw, they've looked at dolphins and mallards, and they said that they both sleep with half of their brain awake and half of their brain obviously asleep, which I found was really fascinating.
I love that fact. That throughout nature, you know, you can see extraordinary efforts made to allow sleep. In the case of dolphins, apparently their breathing is under conscious control, which means, unlike our breathing, which continues when we're asleep, they need to be awake to breathe. And so nature had to design some way by which they could both be awake and get the rest they needed. And so dolphins have this weird brain which can sleep one half at a time. Birds, this is another really interesting and I think strange fact about sleep. You know, if there are like five birds sitting on a wire, the three in the middle can fall asleep completely, and the two on the outside sleep partially. Half their brains fall asleep, but they maintain awakeness in the part of the brain that controls the eye that's looking most outwardly. In other words, the one that has to be alert for predators. You know, from this, Vicky, we know that sleep is incredibly crucial. I mean, if nature is designing such complicated behaviors to maintain sleep, you know, by the logic of evolution, sleep must be crucial. And yet, although we do know some things about sleep, we know it seems to have some role in memory enhancement or memory, you know, in the process of sort of making sure that memories last. And here I'm speaking now of the memory on the level of a neuron, not necessarily remembering, you know, where you were last week, or, you know, what you did what you had for your birthday when you were seven. Although the two memories are probably connected, we know that there's some role sleep plays in memory, but we're not really very far along in knowing exactly what that is. And it ought to be extremely important if it's going to, you know, result in our having this incredible drive to sleep. Because even people who don't sleep well, and many, many Americans don't sleep well, you have an enormous need to sleep. We feel this need so, so deeply all the time.
Yeah, I think nature is really fascinating. I mean, it compensates for so many things. I read that we sleep, less than two hours less per night than we did 100 years ago, and that 56 million prescriptions for sleeping pills per year are written now, and that's 54% up over the past 4 years. That's incredible. So it's obviously a growing American, a growing societal problem.
Absolutely. You know, those numbers from the National Geographic article are, I mean, I was stunned when I found them. I didn't know them but before setting to work on the article, and I was amazed at the growth of sleeping pills, and particularly amazed as I began to look into it at how, you know, we've begun to compress sleep for our convenience. If you look at more less industrialized cultures, you'll find actually that people sometimes still sleep in very different ways. For instance, in some cultures, people don't expect to sleep straight through the night. They actually get up periodically, do things that interest them, go back to sleep. But, you know, their sleep isn't constrained on the other end by an alarm clock. So they actually can kind of get up, you know, when they need to. And that may be a more natural way to sleep. You know, one of the things I explored in the National Geographic piece was, you know, what is the natural way to sleep? And one of the things we looked at in the documentary on the National Geographic channel is more what happens, you know, when we forcibly don't let you sleep. But they're really two ways of looking at the same question.
Yeah, and we used to think that sleep disorders were all psychological. We know that's not true anymore. I guess there may be some psychological disorders, but we know that's not true for most people. Are we getting any closer to actually finding out why some people have this this tendency towards not sleeping? It kind of goes in families, I think, insomnia in general. Did you find that in your research or not?
You know, the thing about insomnia is it's really three or four different problems. For a great many people, the problem of insomnia is really problem about establishing the kind of sleeping conditions that would allow them to sleep. This is what goes under the heading of sleep hygiene. There are a great number of people who have ordinary insomnia, you know, are stressed. And you can see that in cultures that become more pressurized, where there's more time pressure, sleep declines. Italy's a good example where this family is because, you know, back in the 19-teens or 20s, if you like, I don't think that the word insomnia was a word anyone in Italy would have known. But today, you know, Italians have sleep problems almost on the level of American, and it's clearly the result of a, you know, 24-hour society. But you make a very good point, which is that there's also a kind of insomnia, and I know many people who have it, that really, you know, begins so young that it's unlikely that it really comes out of psychological or stress pressures. In other words, you know, you can see if you have children, one child will be a good sleeper, one child won't be a good sleeper. I mean, anybody right. can remember this about their children. And you ask yourself, well, that doesn't really, you know, what's the cause of that? Why? Well, I think the answer is it's basically, you know, physiological. Just as one person is taller than another, some of us have a greater aptitude to sleep, also a greater need to sleep. But, you know, what we don't know, and I'd like to know, and I think it'd be very helpful for a lot of people who have these insomnias, what I would like to call physiological insomnias problems, as one doctor in the National Geographic magazine piece, what he calls problems with the wiring. You know, I'd like to know what these problems are, and I wish there was a lot more research. If you go online, you can see enough people sort of saying, please help us. I wish there was more research on this kind of hardcore insomnia. Insomnia began as a diagnosis, really, of psychologists. You know, Freud and you know, the psychoanalysts were the first to really look at it. It didn't really become a problem for doctors involved with the body until much later. And then there's been a kind of tug of war where, you know, physiologists kind of pulled and pulled until they got a piece of sleep studies. And I think that's been a very good thing for people who have insomnia, because I don't think the psychological explanations are fundamentally, you know, satisfying for enough people.
Right, right. Well, there are so many questions I'd like to ask you, but I have to let you go in a minute. I want to know, what would you like our listeners to know about your book? It was actually voted one of the best nonfiction books. I can't find the information right now, but I know it had accolades written about your book. So Michael Pollan praised it as a riveting detective story that plumbs one of the deepest mysteries of biology. Tell us what you'd like us to know about your book.
You know, one thing that's always been very important to me about the book and about how the book is understood is that it's a story of individual courage and of the much larger question of how we live with disease. Everybody in their family has some issue, some genetic issue, some physical issue, you know, which, you know, just start asking or looking at yourself and saying, what is it that our family worries about? And I think one way to read the family that couldn't sleep is a story about the human condition and about how we all deal with the imperfection, which is, you know, the imperfection of the reality of how we are made imperfect, beyond being a story about insomnia and cultural insomnia and this very, very difficult disease of fatal familial insomnia. You know, it's really a story about all of us.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting, DT Max. I thank you so much for being with us. And the program is called Explorer Fatal Insomnia. And there's also a National Geographic article in the May 2010 issue. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, that was a recording that I did last week because we couldn't get together with schedule. And my guest was DT Max. And check out this month's issue of National Geographic magazine. It's also got an article in there about Mount St. Helens for those of us up here in the Northwest might be interested in that. But there's a lot more information in the article that we could not cover in the interview. And again, you can check out Explorer Fatal Insomnia on the National Geographic channel. Now, for those of you who don't sleep well, we wanted to leave you with this segment with some tips for sleeping, and I'm going to share a list of 10 proven strategies from Shape magazine, written by Gwenda Blair. And we've just got 10 points here. First one, meet your requirements. You need to know, plan ahead of time. It's pretty obvious, right? If you know you want to get 8 hours sleep, you've got to make sure you backtrack on that and get to bed early enough to to meet those 8 hours. Another big one I've read many and many, many places is adjust the atmosphere, because sleep requires a dip in core body temperature. So you may nod off faster in a cooler room. So keep the rule cool, but have your bed warm. So Eric Wright is joining me, and he's got some more tips for us in just a second.
I need all the tips I can get, by the way.
I'm
exhausted.
You were just saying you're exhausted. Another tip is steer clear of stimulants. Again, I think it's pretty self-explanatory. Avoid caffeinated coffees and sodas, sugar-laden snacks, juices, and nicotine, especially later in the day. I actually have given up drinking so much coffee, and I've been sleeping better.
It's a catch-22, because if you can't get to sleep, then you're exhausted during the day,
exactly.
Then you need the caffeine to get through the day, and then you've got so much caffeine and you can't get to sleep, and then you're exhausted during the day, so you need more caffeine. It's a never-ending cycle.
It's a cycle that we don't want to get on, for sure.
Right.
Yeah. Number four, don't multitask your mattress. Condition yourself to associate your bed with the sleep phase in your body's biological rhythm. I think that's a really important one. I don't have anything in my bedroom except sleep stuff. You know, I think I've got friends who've got computers in their rooms and all kinds of things, and I think that's a big thing. So what do you have on your list?
Well, number five here would be shrink your siestas, or in other words, limit your naps
to
a half hour or less, because they say if you sleep too long during the day or during a nap, then, of course, you won't be able to get to sleep later.
Yeah, makes sense.
Number six would be nix the nightcaps and spicy snacks. And it says alcohol may help you fall asleep, but after 4 hours, you may wake up and experience fragmented sleep. So just don't drink too much, apparently. Another one is wind down wisely, like a hot bath or a shower. Other sleep aids include sex, soothing music, slow breathing, and visualization exercises, which all sound good.
Okay.
So, and the other one here is don't just lie there if you haven't fallen asleep in 20 minutes or so. Get out of bed, do something else like light reading.
You mean smashing your pillow doesn't work?
Well, you were telling me a tip about how you can set an internal alarm clock.
This is true. I don't know if this... I grew up with this. My grandmother told me, if you need to wake up at 7 o'clock, tap your head on the pillow 7 times. And I have done that all of my life, and I always wake up about 15, 20 minutes before that time. Huh. I swear.
And how do you set the snooze on that?
Well, exactly. There is no snooze button. I'm sorry about that. If you fall back to sleep, you're tough. Okay, number nine, rise and shine. Wake to a soothing alarm. I think that's important, too, because I can't stand alarm clocks.
Yeah.
So get something that wakes you nicely with, I don't know, chime bells or...
Or wake up to alternative talk, 11:50.
Wake up to 11. Yes, exactly. 11:50 KKNW. And number 10, seek treatment if it's really bad. Insomnia is the most common sleep disorder. We said at the beginning of the segment with DT Max that there are 90 known sleep disorders. So, you know, it may be something you can't control yourself, and maybe you need a little medical help.
Well, one of those things that keeps people awake is being worried, you know.
Yeah.
And now we've got these sleep disorders to worry about. I don't know how we're ever going to get any sleep.
We're doing this so we have information.
Information
is power if we use it well. But it does, sleep disorders affect approximately 30 to 40% of all American adults. So, and again, you know, if you don't have an alarm clock, try my tip of banging your head. If you need to wake up at 6, try it tonight. I want to hear from listeners. I want you to try this. If you have to get up at 6 a.m. tomorrow, tap your head on the pillow 6 times, going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And let me know if you wake up at 6 o'clock the next morning. Please let me know. Send me an email at info@conversationslive.net. All right, my next guest is coming up, Marin McKenna. We're going to talk about a disease or a superbug that medicine has disregarded. Antibiotics can't control it, but we're going to give you some information to help defend yourself against this, especially if you have to go into hospital yourself or have a loved one heading that way. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Next week on Conversations Live, Third Monday series, Vicki explores how you and your business can benefit by developing a strong and viable value proposition. Marketer and Inc. 500 entrepreneur Kevin Daum has developed proven strategies that work to elevate your career in business. Vicki also answers listener questions with Live Your Dream coach Joyce Chapman. Please tune in Mondays at noon Pacific for the live show or visit conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick & Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
Radio for your body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk, 1150.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My next guest is award-winning science and medical writer Maren McKenna. She's an independent journalist for numerous national magazines and a contributing writer at the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. She's also been a fellow with the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation and the University of Michigan. Maren McKenna has written several books. Her latest is Superbug, The Fatal Menace of Mercer. Maren McKenna, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
So the MRSA, M-R-S-A, has certainly been in news headlines for quite a while, but I was really surprised to find out just how long it's been around. You actually write in the book, Maren, you say, for most of my career as a reporter, I took pleasure in being a disease geek, talking to other disease geeks. And then you say, when I contemplated how MRSA advanced while I was not paying attention, I felt as though I'd been telling my readers to stare up at the mountains for fear one of them might one day fall on us, while all the time a flood was rising unnoticed around our feet. And that flood, of course, is MRSA. So let's begin with what it is, how it came about, what it actually does. Let's begin there.
Sure. So MRSA, or MRSA, that acronym has a lot of information packed into it. The SA part is easier, so I'll start with that. It stands for Staphylococcus aureus, which to most people just means staph. Staph is a very common bacterium. Probably a third of us walk around with it on our skin and in our nostrils all the time. And most of the time, so long as it stays on the outside of our bodies, it doesn't make us ill. But if it gets in through a cut or a surgical incision or a scrape, it can cause a bloodstream infection. It can cause infections of the valves of the heart. Back before antibiotics were invented, staph was one of the most common causes of death from infection after injury. For instance, if somebody got shot on the battlefield. Now, the MR, that stands for methicillin resistance. And methicillin is a drug that was invented in 1960, and staph became resistant to it as early as 1961, very, very quickly. You can't even buy methicillin anymore, but it gave its central chemical structure to dozens of antibiotics that were invented afterward, before people understood how this would make bacteria, how bacteria would be invulnerable to those in the same way that it was invulnerable to methicillin. So what this acronym really says is that there's a very common bacterium that can cause very serious illness, and now has become resistant not only to this one antibiotic, but to dozens of other antibiotics that share its structure, which happen to be most of the antibiotics that we use in medicine every day.
Mm. We said at the top of the hour that it's prevalent in hospitals, but it's also been detected in gymnasiums, in schools, in our agriculture, our livestock, in pigs, cows, chickens, even in household pets. How did it get into our food chain?
You know, the history of antibiotic resistance is sort of one long stroll through the Department of Unintended Consequences. We thought when we were inventing antibiotics that we were doing a good thing, and at first we were, because we were placing some brakes on the massive numbers of deaths that came about because of infectious diseases, which were the number one killer back before people lived long enough to have cancer and heart disease and so forth. But as soon as we invented antibiotics, bacteria found a way to protect themselves against antibiotics, and we've been locked in a sort of game of deadly leapfrog ever since. One of the things that we didn't account for is that wherever we use antibiotics, bacteria will become resistant. So we used them in hospitals on people who were ill,
right,
and MRSA and other organisms became resistant in the hospital setting. Then we overused them in children and adults in the outside world, outside hospitals, and now we have what's called community-resistant MRSA. But we also vastly overuse antibiotics in agriculture, particularly in the United States. And since about 2004, people have been finding a third strain of MRSA, not the hospital strain, not the community strain, but a third strain, arising in animals that have been given antibiotics because they're grown in very close conditions. And this bug was first found in the Netherlands in 2004, but it's now hopscotched all across the European Union, and it's been found in Canada and in the United States as well.
Mm, so it's actually, you say this in the book, three overlapping epidemics.
That's right, and I think that this is one of the things that's sort of new news for a lot of people, because if people have heard about MRSA, most of the time they think of it in the context of a hospital infection.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been sort of common knowledge since 1980, when a massive hospital outbreak at Harborview Medical Center in Seattle really kind of made the case that MRSA was a serious hospital danger. But I think a lot of people still really have not gotten the message that there is this community epidemic, which began in the late 1990s, was first identified in Chicago. And that's problematic both because people don't understand what they have necessarily, and also because many doctors have not gotten the message and are still prescribing the wrong drugs. And very few people have heard the news that there is this new third epidemic, this livestock epidemic as well.
Yeah, it's quite scary. But we're going to look at some solutions, or we're going to look at how we can defend ourselves. I want to talk about some actual cases when we come back. We're going to take a very quick break and continue our conversation with Maren McKenna. Her new book is called The Fatal Menace of MRSA Superbug. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500. Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Alternative Talk 1150 is on the interwebs. Dial us up at 1150kknw.com.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Maren McKenna. She's an award-winning journalist, science and medical writer. Her new book is called The Fatal Menace of Mercer Superbug. Medicine disregarded it. Antibiotics can't control it. It's a drug-resistant staph, and she says it may be the most frightening epidemic since AIDS. So I wanted to look in this segment, Maren, at some case studies that you talk about in the book. I mean, I have to say this book's really well written because it reads almost like a novel. It's what I would call literary journalism as opposed to straight reporting.
Thank you.
Yeah. And you say, well, first of all, I want to know, is there a specific age group that it affects more than others?
You know, it's really hard to know. We think at this point that at least 1.5% of the population walk around with MRSA, as opposed to drug-sensitive staph, on their skin and in their nostrils. And often it doesn't make us sick, at least not right away. But that's distributed really widely across the population. Anyone is potentially at risk, unfortunately. But there do seem to be certain groups that are more vulnerable, and it's not so much that they are of particular ages, it's more the conditions in which they live or work or play. And they could be, for instance, professional athletes because they're in very crowded conditions and they have a lot of skin-to-skin contact with each other, or prisoners in jails and prisons because they don't have very good hygiene. Often kids at the start of school, at the start of the school year, will see a sort of a bloom of cases because they're having a lot of skin-to-skin contact, and kids' hygiene in school isn't necessarily great because they don't have to shower after sports anymore.
Oh, really? I did not know that, because we always had to shower after sports.
Yes, I know. I did as well, and I think I resented the children don't have to anymore because it was a trauma for me, yeah. And it should be for them too.
Well, what's so frightening about this bug is that in so many cases, it seems to ravage and deplete the body so very quickly. I wanted to look at a couple of stories that you share in the book. One of them was to do with a baby elephant who contracted the infection. I wonder if you could share that story.
So one of the interesting things in the MRSA story is that that SA in MRSA, Staph aureus, that is the staph strain that is supposed to only affect humans. Almost every species of mammals has their own particular staph strain, but that SA, Staph aureus, is kind of our particular possession. Yet, as people have researched MRSA, they've discovered that humans can give it to animals, and the animals sometimes will be made sick, sometimes not, but they usually hang on to it long enough to reinfect a human. So, for instance, people can accidentally give it to their dogs and cats. So it was found at the San Diego Zoo that one of their baby elephants got mysteriously ill. Now, this poor little thing was ill already. Her mother had had a postpartum infection. They had to take the little elephant away and try to hand rear her, which is a very difficult thing to do and isolate her from the rest of the herd. But as she actually seemed to be recovering and flourishing, and then her keepers noticed that she had an outbreak of sort of pustules and infection, and they thought, oh goodness, the elephant is ill and she's going to give something to us. But it turns out it was MRSA, and in fact, one of them, they've never known who, no one knew that they had it, had probably given it to her because they were walking her and cuddling her and taking care of her, and though she did not survive, and there were other things that killed her, but it certainly contributed to her poor health and eventually to her death. It's a very sad story.
Yeah, it was sad. It was very sad reading it. Another story you share is the story of Diane Lohr, who was, she was infected, and they did not know how or why, but she was pregnant. She had a baby in hospital. When she was looking at footage that her husband had taken of the delivery, she noticed that the nurses had put their finger in the mouth of the baby, and then she ended up having terrible... Well, tell the story.
Sure. So this Diane's story is a perfect illustration of how very tricky MRSA and MRSA prevention are. So I have to say first that before she was a character in the book, she was a friend of mine. We knew each other because we'd worked at the same newspaper. She was the medical editor there. So she knew very well how to protect herself. She knew what her risks were. She was going in for the birth of her third child. This was nothing in this was new to her. And after, and her baby was born by C-section, and as they gave the baby to the mother, the baby for, to start nursing, the baby chomped down and sort of bit her, actually. I mean, she didn't have teeth yet, but close enough. And Diane developed a massive, debilitating infection.
Mm.
But when they tried to figure out what had gone on and they actually analyzed the infection that she had, which was MRSA, it turned out not to be the hospital strain, but rather the community strain. Yet she had pretty much, it was obvious that she had acquired it in the hospital during the birth. So the mystery, which has never really been solved, became, where did this infection come from? It was probably on the baby or in the baby's mouth, though it might actually have been on Diane's own skin. Did something happen while the baby was being born or immediately afterward that caused one of them to become contaminated? Now, Diane believes, though, she has never acted on this belief in any legal way, that when the nurses in her in the delivery suite were trying to coax her daughter to begin sucking, they accidentally contaminated her with their gloves. But, there would not have been any testing done, so there's absolutely no way to prove that. What is very clear is that she didn't know this at the time, she was the leading edge of what's now sort of yet another version of this epidemic, which is that the strains are changing places, but the hospital strain is starting to occur in the community. The community strain is starting to occur in the hospital. They have different resistance patterns. They're virulent in different ways and cause different syndromes, different ways of making you sick. And as a result, if you're not very, very careful, that is to say, if doctors and hospitals are not very, very careful in analyzing exactly what's going on, then somebody could be given the wrong drugs and their illness would continue instead of getting better.
Yeah. I've read many cases where it's been misdiagnosed until it's unfortunately too late. From everything I've read, it seems as though people have many different kinds of symptoms and it can affect them in many different kinds of ways. What are some of the most common?
So you're right. That's one of the things that makes this bug so challenging, is it causes everything from mild skin infections, sometimes just a one-time thing, sometimes, unfortunately, skin infections that recur many times, to devastating illnesses, some of which can kill very quickly. Another story that's told in the book is of two kids in San Diego who developed what's called necrotizing pneumonia that just destroys the lungs as a result of MRSA infection. One child survived after months in the hospital and the other one died. So when people get this out in the everyday world, one of the things they most often describe is that they have something that they think is a spider bite. Now, it's important to say right away that spiders don't carry MRSA, so they haven't been given MRSA by a spider. But what they've got is a little hot pimple that hurts out of all proportion to its size and gets the redness from it expands very rapidly. If you see something like that, something that's small but very, very sore, or where the inflammation or the redness is spreading very fast, it's a good idea to get it looked at. Because in a number of outbreaks, things like this have spread quite quickly into very large skin infections, things that require being checked into the hospital, require surgery, require IV antibiotics. It's really not something to fool with.
Yeah, you talk in the story in the book about a story, and I think this has happened up here in Washington a couple of years ago. I seem vaguely to remember a story happening where guys who play football or baseball were coming, connecting with this, and one of the symptoms that they came down with was boils.
Yes.
They look like boils. So,
and sports teams have found sometimes the whirlpool is contaminated. Sometimes the issue is that if players aren't fully clothed. You know, if it's warm, if it's early in the season and they're wearing short sleeves, they crash into each other and one person's skin comes up against the other. It can be transferred that way. They can scrape themselves on their equipment. There's the story, the book tells the story of a kid in a middle school in a town south of Houston, Texas, who has just this happen. He gets scraped in a tackle by his equipment and, you know, 3 days later he's in the ICU fighting for his life.
Yeah. Well, it's no doubt it's very scary, but we want to look at how we can empower ourselves. So we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk some more with Maren McKenna. Her new book, The Fatal Menace of Mercer, Superbug. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
So deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Looking for new ways to find light, love, healing, and balance in your life, your family, and your work? You're not alone. I'm Jeanette Dames, host of The Soul's Edge, Tuesdays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk 1150. And I want to help you bring your life back to life. Listen to nourish your life or call for an angel reading. Join me on The Soul's Edge, Tuesdays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for joining us on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. If you have comments or questions on any of our shows, we want to hear from you. Email info@conversationslive.net. Call Vicky toll-free at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or leave a message at our special listener voicemail box, 206-414-6159. That's 206-414-6159.
You're listening to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well.
And welcome back. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Maren McKenna. She's an award-winning science and medical writer and independent journalist. Her new book is called Superbug, The Fatal Menace of Mercer. And we only have a few minutes left, but I just wanted to make this one point because I meant to make it earlier. We talked about how we have three overlapping strains which are causing this epidemic in hospitals, in the community, and now in our in animals. And in the book, you do say, Maren, that the food chain is a new strain, and there's no evidence that this transfers to humans, right? Hello? I think we lost her. I heard a little click click. So, Eric, can you call her back real quick? But I think that's an important point to make because we did talk in the, earlier about it being in the food chain and it's integrated into the food chain. But Maren does say in her book that scientific studies so far have found no link that, you know, it can transfer from animals to humans. There are some issues that we're going to talk about when we get Maren back. One of them is she points the finger at why is this not being taken care of? She points the finger at misplaced government spending, inadequate public health surveillance. Nobody's really watching this or monitoring it or tracking it across our nation or across the world because it is in other countries. It's not just here in America. She talks about, points the finger at misguided agricultural practices, which have contributed to the increase of the epidemic. And as she talked earlier, the vast overuse of the drugs that we do have by using so many antibiotics and overusing antibiotics and misusing antibiotics, the drug gets more and more resistant to what we're trying to give the body to take care of it. She calls it the biggest thing since AIDS. And when we get her back on the phone, we're going to find out what we can do to empower ourselves with the knowledge we need to defend against this bug. But it looks as though for some reason Eric's having a hard time getting hold of her. And we want to find out this information because it's the most important information, I think, of all, is trying to find out how we can prevent it. I know one of the things that my mother is in an assisted living facility. She has her own flat. But I know when we had a flare-up of this once when she was in hospital in England, and I asked several of her doctors, you know, what can we do? Because she has five carers a day coming in, and they consistently all said washing hands. But it's not just enough to use soap and water. You've got to really rub those hands vigorously and for a long, long time to make sure the hands are clean. And I think we have our guest back. Marin, are you back with us?
Yes, I'm back. Sorry, the line went bad.
Yeah, okay. Okay, no worries. So I wanted to just get out as quickly as we can what we can do to protect ourselves against this, especially if we know we're going to be going into gymnasiums or we're going to be going to hospital. What can we do?
Right. So there's really two categories of things we have to look at. The first is, what are the things that we can do to protect ourselves individually or our families? And the second is, what can we do to reduce this really international epidemic of antibiotic resistance? The things that we can do to protect ourselves won't fix the larger problem, but they will keep ourselves safe. The easiest thing really is just washing your hands and really washing them thoroughly. And doing other things that keep your hygiene good. For instance, in a gym, since I started reporting this book, I never wear shorts to the gym anymore. I always wear long pants because that way I'm protecting my skin against the surface of the benches. There have been documented outbreaks as a result of gyms. We need to wash our hands regularly or carry a simple hand sanitizer. We need to really ask our kids to stay clean after sports, maybe carry a wet wipe with them if they can't shower. We need to really harass healthcare workers when we or our loved ones are in hospitals to be sure that they're washing their hands, because their days are so busy and so technological, they often get distracted and forget.
Yeah. And I know that when people visit hospitals, they tend to sit on the bed. But I know that one of the reasons doctors and nurses don't like people sitting on the bed is because that's one of the ways we transfer germs. And I never thought about that until I got very severely chastised by a nurse once for doing that.
It really is hair-raising when you think about how many different surfaces there are in hospitals that can harbor bacteria, including MRSA. Not, you know, if you sit on the bed, if you touch the handrails of the bed, in many cases the curtains in something like an emergency room that separate the different cubicles, all of those can be contaminated. But the vehicle that gets things onto your body is your hands.
Right. Okay, so good information. Watch what we're doing with our hands. Watch where we put them. Keep them clean, thoroughly clean. Now, how do we hold our governing bodies accountable for doing something about this?
Right. So many things that we could be doing that we are not now. And the fact that we aren't doing these things is one major reason why MRSA has kind of snuck up on us like this. We still don't really do a good job of counting it. There's no nationwide surveillance. In most places, it's not a reportable disease. So as good as the guesses are about, for instance, 19,000 deaths a year, 7 million doctor visits, those still are just kind of guesses. We don't do a very good job of asking healthcare to be responsible about infection control, which is why when an individual goes into the hospital, we have to harass the healthcare workers. Healthcare in this country has been debating for more than a decade what the best strategies are now, and it's really time for them to show some leadership and make a choice and step up. And finally, if you accept the argument, and I hope people do, that antibiotic use in agriculture is contributing to the development of drug-resistant organisms, then we probably should be voting with our dollars and not buying meat that antibiotics played a role in as the meat was being raised.
Absolutely. I want to just go back to something you said. It's not a reportable disease. With 19,000 deaths a year, how come?
You know, it's a very good question, because that's a really significant number. And in addition, it's probably an underestimate. It's part
partly because of this sense that MRSA just really snuck up on us. You know, we thought it was just an issue in hospitals, and hospitals thought they had it under control. When it was first proposed by some smart doctors in Chicago that MRSA was actually a problem out in the outside world as well, the rest of medicine really didn't listen to them, and it's just never been considered that much of a risk or that much of a threat. And every once in a while, a child dies from it, becomes national news, but then it sinks down below the horizon again. Now, there are a couple of states where citizen activists who had a child who was ill or who were ill themselves have really risen up and forced through legislation, but they still are in the minority.
Interesting. So we're almost at the end of our show. What would you like to leave our listeners with if they take just one thing away today? What should that be?
So the first thing is really to be aware of this. It's a much bigger problem than most people understand. The second thing is not to be paranoid,
because
it's really significant, but you can protect yourself. But the third thing is that antibiotic resistance is, and MRSA specifically, is a really serious problem worldwide, and there are major steps that we have to take if we don't want this to get worse before we run out of antibiotics altogether.
Yeah. I said at the top of the hour that my brother-in-law was brought out of hospital after a day because they had a MRSA infection in the hospital in England. And it sounds like that was a good thing.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Maren, for being with us today. Again, my guest, Maren McKenna, her book, The Fatal Menace of MRSA, Super Drug, Medicine Disregarded It, Antibiotics Can't Control It. Lots of really good information in the book. And where can listeners find your website, Maren?
The website for the book is superbugthebook.com, which has not only excerpts and a blog, but in addition has a great set of links to more information about MRSA for citizen activism, for information about agriculture. We really welcome people there anytime.
Super. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And thank you for being with us. You can reach me at info@conversationslive.net. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.